Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world, and morale. And this is episode 6, getting up to chapter 7, and I'm just trying to stretch myself in several directions. This is podcasting, exposing myself to memory problems. I just found out that I misspelt the word platypus with P-L-A-T-A. I was spelling it as P-L-A-T-Y, platypus. So it's the platypus. That's a horrible way of doing it. And stretching the memory, but also stretching the software. I had just a bit aside, a scare when I had set Google to security level on Google that actually excluded my own apps. I had to change that. Do a while, a couple of minutes to, you know, about 20 minutes, half an hour, to sit down and figure out what's gone wrong there, the story behind it there. But here we've got the platypus, an extraordinary thing about the platypus, for no fault of its own, being assumed by this pre-Darwinistic war on categorization, sort of faulty views anyway, poor methods doing it, and poor little platypus, it turns out, it's just given a barrage of high-powered fire. It's almost like watching an American cop movie, the amount of firing which goes on. You catch a platypus by shooting it and wounding it, and it being a bit crafty, and the first live platypus is running around a Sydney apartment. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see. And of course the French going up and it was sort of riding into obscurity with French science, and the British different people riding their careers up on the back of the platypus. And itself a very fascinating animal, and you learn things, you know, slowly you pick up things like Joseph Banks came out here with gun and greyhounds. It's not the point that you come off. You know, if white man came up here and he was out there blatting away with a gun and greyhounds, fetching all the fauna, or if you're going to check if something is producing milk by injecting mercury into the warm, you know, warm carcass of a platypus to see mercury come out of its milk duct. It's a pretty amazing thing. And so as always, there's the title, The Paper War, and the quote from Umberto Eco, Kant and the platypus. What? What? That is amazing. A book called Kant and the Platypus. People know that I've actually done a podcast on Kant. Big German. I do remember the not other and trying to look at different definitions of infinity to work out what God was. And being trying to outpace the track of Newton and pushing the theological work forward. Creating sort of like Kant was like a bridge, a theological bridge, which allowed science to advance. It's a really amazing thing to see. Okay, the quote from this book is: "The need to categorize gave free play to the imagination of the men of science." George Bennett. This is sort of a similar thing that. Kant himself acted as a conduit for people to try and shop the theology, and they wound up discovering more science. And he, I think, is probably saying the same sort of thing, that categorization is an activity which you're thinking of doing, but it's contaminated by so much imagination that wouldn't happen otherwise. The imagination would be bottled out unless you had this process of setting it out. George Bennett's paper, this is the guy that you know, went out into the bush and actually gathered up heaps of platypuses, and also spoke with the Aborigines, who had a remarkably strong knowledge of what was going on. George Bennett's paper vividly illuminated the living appearance, anatomy, and much of the ecology of the platypus when it was published in Britain in 1835. And for some three quarters of a century, it remained the primary distributor. Yet even as he laboured in New South Wales, debate on the missing nipples and the alleged mammary glands of the perplexing animal reached something like a fever pitch in England. This is pretty amazing. I suppose breasts and womanhood go together. Jeff Roy, which is a French person who thought it'd be snooty by putting his first name next to his second, Saint-Hilaire, Geoffrey Saint-Hilaire. And they go, oh, Jeffrey's. Jeffrey's a nice name. Jeff Roy, which, with an instance of infallibility. And there was a Cuvier. Cuvier's a little fat dwarf. Okay. And determination that escalated in France's distinguished zoologists with the age, expelled a scatter of papers in 1833-35, assaulting Owen's and Meckel's conclusions that glands of the platypus were mammary glands, and arguing that the young animal, with a mouth like a bird, could not possibly suckle from a breast that lacked a nipple. Put on your platypus. These, he proclaimed roundly, were not mammary glands. Ticking off his objections in a series of papers which he placed in the Transactions of the Zoological Society of London, a journal that Owen himself had founded, Jeff Roy argued that the liquid produced from the site was certainly not milk, the most that could be expected from glands, with such simple structure as a platypus displayed, was, at best, nutritious mucus eaten by the young. Yum. Possibly it was a secretion dispersed in water for the young after hatching. Alternatively, like the musk glands of the shrew, the liquid was designed to attract a mate. Finally, it was conceivable that the monotremous glands, as he carefully dubbed them, secreted carbonate of soda to form a shell around the egg. Owen chartered the French anatomist from across the channel, could make the necessary chemical analysis of the secretion. Okay. Confident of 30 years that the monotremes were oviparous, an egg-laying duo of reptilian nature belonging to the monotrema, the distinct order of vibrata, which he himself created, Geoffrey threw his hat into the ring. Through all his propositions, the one thing he was sure, the oviparity decreed an absence of mammalae. So if it's putting out eggs, it can't breastfeed. It was wholly unnatural to have a mammiferous, milk-producing, egg-laying animal, an amphibian mammal. Worse, it went against the all-powerful rules of the very plan of nature. Quote, I merely wished to play a useful part, he added in his own defence, beguilingly in his 1833 paper, an observation of the nature of dermal glands of the Orthiohynchbus. I'm going to have to get it. Resisting myself to the obligation of a naturalist, having the privilege of age, confident in experience, folder studies, and acquainted with the possible variations of nature in order to assist observers less practiced than myself in the study of natural history. Well, no. Yeah, what can I say? The plague, every age is replete with wankers. Sorry for using that English. Richard Owen was up to the fate. With a number of consummate papers behind him, he already walked authoritatively on the biological stage. He was a brilliant zoologist, equipped his contemporaries, and has brains enough to fill two hats. The Royal College of Surgeons and the Hunterian Museum were the key centre of comparative anatomy in Britain. He had married the daughter of curator William Cliff, and his own position as assistant curator gave him dominance of the museum's collections. Well, there you go, married into collection. He also had access to other museums and to a diverse spread of animals that were given to the dime at the zoo, who were given to die at the London Zoo. That was beautiful. party or die. Owen, too, was already beginning to act as a magnet for information from collectors around the world. His friend Bennett witnessed evidence from Australia was a key buttress to his factual story. The milk gland was very large. Bennett had confirmed in his letter of 1833, quote, I can now inform you the actual observation that milk is secreted from it. It does come out, as your mercury did when you injected it into the ducts, in small ducts on the surface of the skin. There was another reinforcement. During 1834, Owen was able to examine the neonates, the two baby platypuses, which Lieutenant Mayer had sent him from New South Wales. These were under his knife. He established two definitive facts. The suckling infant's mouth was not a duck-like in its embryonic form, but distinguished to allow it to imbibe nourishment from the glands of the normal site. And secondly, the substance found in the baby's stomachs was milk. Banville, who succeeded Cuvier's chair in comparative anatomy in the Museum of Natural History in Paris, following his master's death in 1832, rallied behind the mammary glands. Oh, okay. A comparative anatomist of high distinction, he looked for order and chaos of nature based on the principles anchored firmly in God's design. He argued that, regardless of the substance of the glands secreted, they must be identified as mammary glands since they perform the same nourishing function. Round one had gone to Owen, yet in the paper war with Jeffrey, Owen looked for bridges. Although elderly and overbearing Frenchman managed soon afterwards to block Owen's election to the Foreign Correspondent of the Prestigious Institute de France, Owen offered a partial olive branch. His own anatomical dissections, his mercury injection experiment, and his correlation of the size of the mammary gland with changes in the ovaries in the female platypuses, he set down his detailed papers on response to Geoffroy. All pointed to the place of melatrines occupied as mammals within the classified order of nature. His finding on echidna supported him, but he was willing to stress the affinity between Mammalia and Geoffroy's monotrema, which engage clearly in their circulatory, respiratory and nervous system. In the Anglo-French paper war, Owen emerged victorious. His careful empirical research prevailed. The monotremes were, accordingly, a clear place within the definition of mammals. These highly aberrant Australian animals could now be given a firm taxonomic position within the class of Mammalia, pushing out its boundaries and demonstrating for all systemists how wide the variation of natural types within a class could be. Yet, much was still to be done. Despite this new anatomical knowledge, monitoring's methods of generation remained a crucial unknown. Oviparous, as Elder Home, Geoffroy and Lamarck decreed, viparous, as many other naturalists believe, or oviviparous, which is incubating and hatching their young within their mother's body. Only precise information on the egg provided by naturalists in the field, Owen repeated, could determine the creature's process of reproduction. Yet, even when he exhorted, his own preference was clear. From his various dissections of platypus, Owen favoured omnivivorous reproduction and contended that its failure to find eggs was itself indicative of the dissolution of the mother's body. Okay. He judged, moreover, that it, so they don't actually lay eggs, but they actually do. He judged, moreover, that it was now necessary to believe that the mammiferous animal must necessarily be viparous to give to live young. A belief in the animal's oviparity, as he saw it, had only been necessary before the confirmation of mammary glands, when it could be assumed that the egg yolk was required to provide nourishment for the young. Underpinning the differing scientific opinions, so even he got it wrong. So they actually lay eggs. Overpinning the differing scientific opinions held by naturalists was a sweep of philosophical and theological ideas that coupled responses to organic classifications and to changing interpretations of nature's origin and laws. The concept of the chain of being, which is known evolution, life in a ladder, fixed development from the lowest to the humblest forms, up to man, which is the chain of grace, had reached its zenith in the first half of the 18th century, and its language could still be heard amongst the early 19th century savants. But by the first years of the 19th century, Cuvier's innovative thrust into comparative anatomy had dealt a heavy blow. From his influential position at the Paris Museum of Natural History, he introduced the concept of four major divisions of organic life: radiata, jellyfish and starfish, articulata, worms and insects, mollusks, snails and octopus, and vertebrata. To account for the complexity, he could not be accommodated in a single plan that progressed from the simplest to most complex. So people were trying to say that worms, sort of really important pre-evolution, just moving, you know, like a pre-move for evolution. You move worms and mollusks separately from our evolutionary tree. It's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle. You start to sort them out into places. A master of comparative forms, he saw organic life as an immense network of species dependent on each other. Abandoning the chain of being, Cuvier introduced the concept of correlation of parts, based on recognition that organs were created with their organs so shaped as to enable them to adapt to their conditions of existence. It was a static world, in his view, no longer one where progressive tendencies through the adaptive forms were seen as part of the divine purpose. Researching in 1810, it was catastrophist. I really have to understand what's going on. I can remember, was he a catastrophist, that things were going on and serious catastrophes happening? Researching in 1810 among the strata of the Paris Basin, Cuvier brilliantly applied the principle of correlation to the parts to the fossil record. There, to his astonishment and slight delight of the peers and public, he found the smallest fragment of bones, however insignificant, possessed a fixed and determined character that related it across the broader classes, order, family, genus, and species of animals which it belonged. Thus, by careful analogy and comparison, working from the fossil tooth there, jawbone, femur there, it became possible to reconstruct a striking array of gigantic and extinct animal forms. The new discipline of paleontology ushered in a far-reaching change. Large new questions confronted biologists and geologists: how the universe of design could these extraordinary resurrected creatures have been formed? Have they all existed at the beginning of life on Earth, altering the size and form due to the changing physical environment over long eras of time? Or had they been created by a divine hand at specific times? Ah, yes. Cuvier's arts are laid in catastrophism and separate creation. While an Orthodox Christian, he originally believed this meant an immense network had been fixed from 6 days of biblical creation from fossil reaches. He now, see, amazing how that goes in, how he now perceived that reptiles had appeared on land long before mammals, and that now extinct species were first in the world's Earth record, and that was only in the most recent geological strata that fauna appeared mostly identical to the present day. Cuvier, the mammoth, so he's the fat little man, large in mind and substance, now seized on the view, as several geologists had before him, that physical catastrophes commonly in the biblical flood had repeatedly destroyed organic life, which was replaced after each catastrophe with successive creations. That's right, that's him. Each, with each separate creation, new, more complex, but unrelated species appeared. Lamarck saw the different situation differently. An expert in invertebrates, the professor with Cuvier at the Paris Museum, he conceived the natural order as classes arranged in a linear fashion from almost complex descending to the least developed forms. Nature, he argued, having constructed the simplest animals and plants directly, produced others from them by spontaneous generation. Changing physical needs and environments led to new responses which sparked new habits in the organisms. Modifications required in the organism's lifetimes were passed on through reproduction and inheritance and acquired characteristics. So you had Cuvier, which is catastrophism, and sequential new creation events, and then Lamarck is pre-evolution, and he's saying that when the giraffe has to stick its neck up higher, its neck goes slightly smaller. When he confronted the puzzle of the fossil record, Lamarck rejected extinction, but underlined the importance of fossils in revealing the past change. Species, his theory of transformation, RAM, were transmuted into living descendants through a change effected over very long periods of time. Through this lens, Lamarck rejected catastrophism and argued continuity of past and present. His followers called it the Lamarckian evolution. So it is, he came up with evolution before Darwin, except he didn't have survival of the fittest with it. These divergent positions strained and sundered the international community of science. Cuvier deplored his colleague's theory as an affront to Christian belief. Giffroy, also working in the museum, accepted the transmutation of species, but not the Lamarckian transformation. Cuvier, former pupil Branville, no longer a disciple or admirer of his master, held to the chain of being while allowing for changes to species and classes. I think you need this, all this cultural thing, because Cuvier had revolution, which corresponded, was, if you look at his theories corresponded more with the French Revolution. That's why they put Lamarck for the back, and then you've got the other person back saying the feudal view. It's interesting, the social views which go with it. From his own paleontological researches, Banville claimed that gaps in the chain of existing organisms would be supplied in fossil forms. Together, he postulated, extinct organisms testify the fullness and rightness of God's creation. So this, I sort of can sort of see this more in three dimensions, you know, for multiple dimensions. I can see it in dimensions of different evolutions, but also different dimensions of social order. So he's going for religion. In the chain of completeness and rightness, Mandel assigned the Australian platypus to the base of the descending order of organisms from man, through the placentas, marsupials, and to monotremes. Across the channel in Britain, a slew of viewpoints flourished. A distinguished professor of geology of Oxford, William Buckland, who, unlike many geologists of the period, did not consider it possible to reconcile geology with the Book of Genesis, believed the new forms of organic life came directly from the intervention of a creator. Oh my God. God, he also wrote with passion and eradication about the catastrophic universal deluge and the impact on the history of Earth. Good on you. Here's the next person. By 1830, the youthful geologist Charles Lyell gripped attention. He was a gradualist, wasn't he? Okay. And drew converts to the theory of uniformitarianism, a theory challenging catastrophism and founded on the conclusion from his own geological observations that changes in the Earth crust occur slowly and cumulatively by the forces still in action over vast periods of geological time. I think it's because he found a rock in the Roman wall, which, you know, the Romans had put, but it hadn't aged at all, something like that. He launched his pervasive theory in the Principle of Geology, published that year. Lyell, however, rejected organic progression found in Lamarck's evidence as fanciful. Yet, while recognised that species could become extinct as a result of failure in the struggle for existence, saw that extinct species were replaced by others, he fell back before any evolutionist explanation. Now, I'm just trying to think, it's... it's Charles Darwin's father, Erasmus. That's, I really can't place that in. The idea of Archdeacon William Paley, spelled out in his Natural Theology in 1802, was a compelling hold on men's minds. Paley's view of the universe implied an intelligent and benign creator whose work was everywhere to be seen. The bird's feather in flight, webbed feet, water travel patches, carrying young across dry distances, the stretching tongues of the woodpecker and catching grubs were all instances of design. Design applied to a designer. That person, Paley proclaimed, is God. In his lucid prose and confident theological, drew an analogy with the watchmaker, who, that's 1802, is still doing his, does his head in, doesn't it? Who creates an intricate machine and sets it in motion. To illustrate his idea of complete regulated design, his book was prescribed reading at universities. Okay. In this intellectual climate where theology was intricately linked with genealogy and natural history, it's interesting that Priestley, he's what, 1802, around that time, if you weren't Church of England, you couldn't go to university. It's just, yeah, God. Men turned to miracles to explain any new unexpected phenomena they encountered. Creationism, creationism, and separate creation were purposeful. God sacrificed a whole series of his creatures only to invent them afresh at different times and other centres of development. Were concepts that were appraised only slowly as the century advanced. In this environment, Richard Owen became one of the preeminent scientists of Britain, deeply influenced by Cuvier, who is the catastrophist, who he visited in Paris in 1830, 2 years before. Mammoth's death, which is Cuvier's name, because he's a big, fat, round person, he honed his skill in comparative anatomy, and 4 years later applied his mind to fossils remains, invited to describe the fossil bones which Darwin brought back from South America after the Beagle voyage. Propelled by a workaholic zeal, Owen reached, researchers stretched out over, what is the line? Is it the Owen Dixon line? Is it the, no, I can't remember. Propelled by workaholic zeal, Owen's research stretched out across the British Empire and into a rich fossil reservoir of the Earth. In a century of unfolding ideas and new far-reaching classification, he stood as the impresario of the fossil record, the British Cuvier, reconstructing a vast cavalcade of huge extinct fauna from teeth and bones dredged from British, Australian, New Zealand, African, and South American soils, launching his early zoological investigation profoundly influenced by Cuvier. And fiercely opposed to transformationism, Owen emerged. Sorry, anti-transformationism is the class with which in evolution occurs. Owen emerged increasingly in his paleontological researches as a successive and conscientious creationist. He held that each species had been created only once in a time and space, but its diffusion was a result of its own law of reproduction under enlarging or restrictive influence of external circumstances. Oh, God. What's his name again? This is Owen. God. Nature, he acknowledged, had advanced with a slow and stately steps, offering a unity of plan and plants and animal kingdom. This plan offered both clear relationships between species, in the case of vertebrates furnished a distinct archetype, by which all vertebrates, animals, and variations in theme, webbing his argument together from a maze of living and extinct forms, Owen came to see the variations expressing a distinct advance. Working assiduously, he marked a purposeful and repetitive structure of the animal kingdom, which he contended with certainty flowed from the benevolent sovereign of the universe, an all-wise and all-powerful first cause. My God, that's down to Aristotle. Oh, we have not gone anything. Okay. Richard Owen represented the cutting edge of British establishment science, but tucked within his huge research output, God's purposeful plan for the Australian monotremes had yet to unfold. So, it's pretty beautifully put. There's a picture of him, and he looks a big-headed dude. Richard Owen, quote, a tall man with great glittering eyes, as his friend, historian Thomas Collar, described him. He holds a fossil bone in one of one of the giant extinct creatures he brilliantly is recreating. So he was actually put the dinosaurs, but they all believe in creations. 28 minutes in, and Darwin's platypus goes for a fair number of pages. Okay. Chapter 8, Darwin's Platypus, from Charles Darwin. Darwin, a disbeliever in everything beyond his own reason, might exclaim, surely two distinct creators must be at work in terms of this one. On a cold day on the 7th of December, this is Charles Darwin's Platypus, Charles Darwin, aged 22, a newly minted graduate of Cambridge University, set off on an unpaid naturalist on His Majesty's ship Beagle on her four-year voyage of navigation to survey and establish the chronometrical stations. Oh, really? To establish chronometrical stations around the world. Well, I didn't know that. You know, I don't know if you know the various observatories have the big ball, and the big ball drops at midday. So it's a photonic thing. So they have this ball, raises up, and just at midday, the big ball on all the observatories drop down. So that was the purpose of the mission. I didn't know that. Young Charles was not particularly obvious choice for the protected task. A timely serendipity intervened. Educated at Shrewsbury School, where he considered his education simply a blank. Darwin was a late developer. He attended Edinburgh University Medical School, swooned at operations, hated medicine, independently picked up some natural history and principles of classifications, and contemplating a life in holy orders, transferred to Cambridge. There he battled with mathematics, became interested in entomology, was charmed and convinced by the writings of Archdeacon William Paley. Now, what Paley... Oh, Paley is the... I have to go back. What did Paley do? View the universe multiplied, intelligent creator. A bird's he believed Paley, which is intelligent design. Okay, Paley and his argument about the universe's beneficial orders of design, and studied geology. There too, he gave an ascending tick. To the prevailing duly concept of catastrophism. That things changed in a big bing. Darwin joined Beagle though on the say-so of his professor of Cambridge, John Henslow, who, when offered the prospect of a long sea journey and scientific discovery, declined the job himself. Young Darwin, known as the grandson of the famous Erasmus Darwin, and judged, quote, the best qualified person likely to undertake such a situation, okay, was made an offer not on the grounds of, as the professor explained, of Darwin's being a Finnish naturalist, but one amply qualified for collecting, observing, and noting anything worthy to be noted in natural history. So worked the old and new boy network, and such was the discerning insight of the Cambridge professor of botany. It was thus that Charles Darwin, the most promising naturalist of his age, came to view the amazing improbable platypus in the habitat and enlist it to his cause. After several years at sea, landfall in South America, Galapagos Island, brief stops Tahiti, New Zealand, Charles Darwin arrived at Sydney on January 1836 on a homeward leg of the Beagle Survey. Now, the first British ship to go to Tahiti, which is before Cook, had a problem that the natives traded sex for anything metal. So all the nails got ripped out of the ship and it nearly sank. That's a pretty amazing story. The time spent making passages, the chronometrical surveys he wrote to his sister discreetly, is so to me... so much existence obliterated from the page of life. There never was a ship so full of homesick heroes as a Beagle. Stopping in Sydney, only long enough to notice that this was, quote, a wonderful colony, ancient Rome, in her imperial grandeur, could not have been ashamed of such an offspring. Darwin, adopting his usual practice, hired a horse and a man to guard him, rode off to the Blue Mountains, crossing the Great Dividing Range, by the road convicts had carved through the high mountains. So we just walked there just a few minutes before, just half an hour ago we were walking above that. He stayed overnight at a large pastoral property called Cox's River, Wallerang. To the manager, he carried a letter of introduction. So that's where the scouts go camping, Cox's River. In the dusk of the evening, he wrote in his diary, I took a stroll on a chain of pools, which in this country represents a course of a river. and had the good fortune to see several of the famous platypus. They were diving and playing in the water, but very little of their bodies was visible, so they only appeared like so many water rats. Mr. Brown shot one. Certainly it was the most extraordinary animal. The mounted specimens, Darwin concluded, observing the soft and pliable bill of a live animal, do not convey the proper ideal of the head and beak, let it be contracted and hardened. Gee, this is a poor platypus. It's just one white man comes and just blows him away. And I must admit, I've been up around there. There's no... Well, I can't see any platypuses. There's sort of secret ponds in the Blue Mountains that only locals know about. There are no platypuses. There's lots of crayfishes, lots of crustaceans. If I could say quickly, someone led some anti-termite juice, poured it into a local river, and it was just choking with crayfish yabbies. There's heaps of yabbies in there. Lots of invertebrates. I don't know where the platypuses are. The experience clearly moved Darwin, writing a few days later in his host, Admiral King, one of the colony's most preeminent scientists, whose son was a midshipman on the Beagle, he encountered. In the evening, we went with a gun in pursuit of the platypi and actually killed one. I considered it a great fear to be in at the death of such a wonderful animal. Darwin viewed the fabled creature with a mind that was not entirely unprepared. He was aware of the classic recycled. He had read the grandfather's Zoomer, which had briefly, but while the reality pondered the mating habits of Australia's curious beasts. Ah, that's right. That's what his father did. He said that all these animals just fornicated and produced something. In Edinburgh's in the 1820s, he had made acquaintance with the prominent radical naturalist Robert Grant. That's right. I had to remember what he did. Robert Grant, who himself was scientifically interested in the platypus, and who, on walks with the young student, talked. You can see my memory coming back slowly, slowly, guys. To him, to Lamarck's theory of evolution. It was a theory Darwin met again, although this time under severe attack, in Charles' Principle of Geology, in which he carried in the Beagle. Volume 2, to his delight, reached him at Rio de Janeiro. Wow! That is amazing. Is that, sorry, he's got a book, and second book is being printed, and it gets crossed over for Rio de Janeiro. Darwin absorbed Lyell's theory of an infinitely long, gradually changed development of physical world set, as the author saw it, against the universe's static organic creation. The dry Antropian landscape, the young naturalist came to ruminate on the star player of Australia's fauna, Darwin. Early in the evening, he jotted in his diary at Wallerang Station, I had been lying on the sunny bank and reflecting on the strange character of the animals in Australia compared to the rest of the world. A disbeliever in everything beyond his own reason might exclaim, surely there are two distinct creators must be at work. But moments later, Darwin noticed a conical pitfall in the ant lime, which observed how it shot jets of sand to prey exactly as... Oh, right. At moments later, Darwin noticed a comical pitfall of the antlion, which and observed how it shot jets of sand and its prey exactly the same genus. Although a different species did in the old world. So I don't know if you know this, there's antlions. There's little insects, and they go in the sand, and they make a little cone, and when the ants fall in it and they start struggling, the antlion starts firing sand up the top and makes the ant slowly fall down into these gaping jaws. Okay, now he asks, what would the disbeliever say to this? Would any two women ever hit on such a beautiful, so simple yet artificial contrivance? It cannot be thought so, he answered himself. The one hand has surely worked over the whole world. Paley, it seemed to him then, was right. It was a perfect design of one overseeing designer, although he was ready to know. A geologist, perhaps, would suggest that periods of creation have been distinct and remote with one from another. The creator rested in his labour. Several years of research and thinking lay ahead before Darwin carefully set yet trusting mind fully marshalled. Beautiful plates of platypus. Oh, this an echidna. Beautiful plates, plates. Beautiful colour plates in here. Evidence of isolation and modification of the species as a major agent of evolution and organic change. Yet his Australian experience fed the process. In a remote property of New South Wales, it's not remote, it's just over the mountains, he had sighted Australian crows like jackdaws, a bird like a magpie, similar to the English birds of the same name that plainly belonged to a different species. A miniature kangaroo the size and locomotion like an English rabbit, and a wonderful animal which immediately resembled a water rat as seen in the summer evening. There were examples of animals similarly adapted but wildly separated geographically, which belonged to different orders, species, and genera species. The platypus remained etched in his consciousness, observing the grotesque African plant of the desert, Welwitschia mirabilis, with its long coiled leaves writhing like vegetable octopus. Latin Q, he dubbed this floral mixture of a primitive and advanced the vegetable platypus, basically. The platypus of the plant kingdom. The advanced yet primitive animals of the antipodes, the sleek and small, elusive platypus, drifted into Darwin's maturing ideas on biogeography and diversity. Back in England, the young man who had gone forth and wrapped in the prevailing theological and creationist philosophies of this period returned a scientist committed to empirical evidence of his own inquisitive synthesizing ideas. Getting his absorbing account of the voyage of the Beagle quickly into print in 1837, Darwin began to jot down his seminal transmutation notebooks based on findings of the voyage shored up by his voracious reading. Yet, even before he began to write the famous notebooks, he had, from his own eyewitness observations, already began to question Paley's static, positively purposeful design universe and the immutability of species to shape the concept of transmutation. Victorian naturalists, acceptance of separate creations and their belief that the new successive creation followed each other, major distinguishing upheaval of the earth, appeared to him riddled with holes. Piling up a stack of weighty tomes around him, Darwin plunged into the writings of his contemporaries in botany, zoology, paleontology, geology, plant and animal breeding, laboriously seeking facts. In 1837, his evolutionary theory took shape. Rereading his friend Lyell's Principles of Geology, he saw pieces as fully determined and fixed, he scribbled jauntily. If this were true Adair's theory, he was equally resistant to Lamarck's notion of evolutionary adaptation and progressionism spelled out. So the philosophy, zoology, scrawling on his own copies. What he said is great. Lamarck, a very poor and useless book. After 4 years exploring diverse landscapes around, which is one thing is, you really have to say, he wasn't out there to hurt people. He was just a scientist saying, and all these people come in and do their interpretations over the top of it. It makes me upset. It makes me angry. After 4 years exploring diverse landscapes around the world, Darwin was more than alert than any of his predecessors and contemporaries to the relevance of geographical distribution of features and the effect of isolation on the modification and range. Working on his great species book for nearly 20 years before committing it to print, he drew the platypus into the synthesizing scene, writing to the young botanist Joseph Hooker. In 44, he puzzled over those genera which were not typical, a feature of the platypus, with its peculiar mammary, concluded that such genera were rendered atypical by extinction of allied genera. Okay, so it's end. Darwin was wrestling with the question of the fewness of species and the aberrant genome, and needed to explain this against the argument of creationists. For creationists, such oddities would be described as products of creation, creative whim. For Darwin, the platypus or echidna, with their lack of radiating subfamilies, were both few and aberrant, and they posed problems for the theory of evolution by natural selection. Yet, they would surely be anomalous, he reasoned with the doubting Hooker. If they had a dozen species instead of one, Hooker was a sounding board. Such anomalous forms as the platypus, along with the air-breathing landoid fishes. Wow. Darwin wrote to him, unravelling his own ideas. I'll see if I can remember glandoid fishes, air-breathing fishes. Were exemplars of the genera that had arrived through natural selection at a lower stage of perfection in their smaller areas of habitation, their species inhabiting a much larger area and confronting greater competition. He allied them with species which inhabited fresh water. Yet, writing to his friend Lyle in the early reflective years, he also saw the phenomenon of the platypus as obtaining its beak by retrograde recurrent development, whatever that means. For, as he put it, the platypus united in one organism disparate characters from different embranchment, the bill of a bird, the skeletal resemblance to reptiles, the hair and body of a mammal. However, he pointed out to Lyle, natural selection acts exclusively by preserving successive slight useful modifications, hence natural selection cannot possibly make a useless or rudimentary organ. A nascent organ, though little developed, must be useful in every stage of development. The mammary glands of the platypus may perhaps be considered as a nascent compared to the udder of cows. Darwin's ideas aired informally in the letters to close colleagues would appear coherently in The Origin of Species in 1859. Writing lucidly there on the fundamental question of classification, he accepted the correlation of characters derived from parts as the true formula for determining an animal's taxonomic position. By such correlation of the part, even if trifling naturalists could identify a character which was nearly uniform and common to a great number of forms, but not common to others, and use it as one of value. Okay, well, that's i.e. saying that the part is distinctive, it's useful to use. In such taxonomic determination, this is the shape, the platypus offered an illustrative case. If the platypus has been covered with feathers instead of hair, Darwin gave it as a key example. This external trifling character would have been considered by naturalists as important as an aid to determining the degree of affinity of this strange creature to birds and reptiles as an approach in structure in any one internal organ. However, as a confusing taxonomic aspect, the platypus was an explicit player in Darwin's idea on the isolation of species and diversity. Quote, in Australian Animals, he later developed his thoughts succinctly in his eloquent and persuasive books, we see the process of diversification in an early incomplete stage of development. He noted again the enduring character of the organic forms of fresh water. In such an environment, new forms, he went on to suggest, will have been more slowly produced than old forms more slowly exterminated. In fresh water, he wrote, we find some of the most anomalous forms of the known world, as the platypus and the leopard siren, I don't know what it is, which, like fossils, connect certain extant orders not widely separated in a natural scale. These are anomalous forms. I'll have to work out what they say. Oh, I've forgotten that the animal which I was going to look up. Oh, my God. Something around the fish. What's the name of that fish? I lost it. It's gone. Oh, dear. And it summed up. The anomalous forms, he summed up, may almost be called living fossils. They have endured to the present day, having inhabited a confined area and confined from thus having exposed to less severe competition. Darwin's platypus was a wonderful animal. He had shot in the tranquil Australian River. Became indeed a strong case in his argument for the survival of the fittest. Oh, isn't that beautiful? I shot it, and it's a strong case for survival of the fittest. Retrograde recurrent development, it may well exhibit, but it was a staunch survivor. Through nature's granted vast periods of time for the work of natural selection, Darwin reminded readers in The Origin, she does not grant an indefinite period. If any one species does not become modified and improved in corresponding degree with its competitors, it will soon be exterminated. Such were finished products in 1859, Darwin's thinking on the monotreme. Yet 20 years earlier, Australia also contributed a major flashpoint to the understanding of his broad theory of evolution that broke upon him from the evidence of the fossil record, later to his return to England in 1836. The great South American fossil bones he carried back from London on the Beagle prove ignition points. Unearthing these records from ancient geological time, Darwin had expected that the bones would prove that to be European or African rhinos, Anacidon, not specifically South American types. Richard Owen's description of the classification of them in his appendix to Darwin's Voyage on the Beagle brought him up short. As if, though a luminous prism, he saw the close relationship between extinct giant species and the living sloths and armadillos. These facts, he noted graphically in his journal, origins in all my views. Okay. Skirmishing in the literature, he hit upon a vital collaborating evidence from the Wellington Caves of New South Wales. While the Beagle, so there's the Darwin walk up here, so there's various walks. Wherever you landed, there's a Darwin walk. You can walk up where you walked up the mountains of Wellington. Fit fast. Yeah, look. Like it's a path nowadays, and you're straining it to do, and he just covered it in no time whatsoever. What he's doing. While the Beagle had been making passages around the world, the Australian cave discovery of the early 1830s fell like an arrow into a tight-held creationist theories in Britain. During the 1830s, an Australian colonist, George Rankin, foster king in a distant pastoral country in southwest New South Wales, had discovered the Wellington Caves, where, to his astonishment, he unearthed a rich haul of fossils of giant extinct marsupials. Rankin packed some off to the colony surveyor general and scientifically Sir Thomas Mitchell. So we have the Mitchell parrot, real dumb parrot. Mitchell's eagerly explored the site himself and dispatched a selection of the fossil fragments to a professor of natural history in Edinburgh University. These remarkable fossils soon reached the Huntington Museum in London for the expert examination of William Clift. Now, William Clift was a curator and married the daughter. I can't remember. So who was the... Oh, I can't remember. Clift's identifying of fossils, teeth and jaws, femurs, as belonging to giant extinct kangaroos, wombats and dasyuri carnivorous marsupials that roamed Australia countryside in the tertiary period, at once raised doubts about the universal deluge so ardently advocated Professor Geology William Buckland and other geologists as major agents of the Earth's change, and threw up further questions marks from another corner of the world about the concept of geological terrestrialism and separate creation. In the first place, the cave finding furnished an initial evidence of past geographic distribution of animals in Australia, a distribution that matched evidence coming to light of extinct gigantic animal forms in Europe. Second, the evidence indicated that the genera to which Wellington Cave's fossil belonged to continued with a highly distinct organisation to inhabit the Australian continent in present times. This question exposed a real puzzle, for if, as the catastrophists and separate colorationists claimed, the animals and plants of the tertiary era were destroyed in biblical floods and replaced subsequently by a special created issue of new flora and fauna, why should a clear continuity prevail between existing species and extinct forms? Okay, so it's sort of pretty obvious. You know, you've got a giant kangaroo that's there. So this is, Coolivia had catastrophism and God subsequent creationism after. Surveyor General Mitchell was alive to this coup. I understand Buckland's nose is put completely out by the joint by the bones of Australia, he wrote jubilantly to Aiken. I've now heard that the fact that fossil bones belong to animals similar to those now existing has worked a great change in all they learned of speculating on such subjects. So it's interesting that creationism was dealing multiple blows before Darwin walked through it. Darwin, for his part, had read the allusion to Clifft's findings in Lyell's second volume, Principles of Geology, in 1833, during the Beagle Voyage. But it was his access to detailed evidence in 1837 that firmed his view of transmutation. He would describe in it in The Origin. Mr. Clifft, many years ago, showed the fossil animals from Australia caves are closely allied to living marsupials on that continent. The South American reservations also showed that the fossil animals buried there in such numbers are related to the South American types. I was so much impressed with these facts, he wrote, that I strongly insisted in 1839 and 1845 on this law of succession of types and on the wonderful relationship in the same continent between the dead and the living. On the theory of descent and with modification, he summed up in his clarifying prose, quotes from, the great law of long-enduring but not immutable succession of the same types within the same areas is at... Hopefully come to any of this. Ah, yes, we are. Once explained, God... For the inhabitants of each quarter of the world will obviously tend to leave in that quarter during the next succeeding period of time, closely allied through some degree of modified descendant. If the inhabitants of one continent formerly differed greatly from those of another, so will their modified descendants still differ in nearly the same manner of degree. So there you go. It's not quite... I suppose Darwin went out in the back of here. This is... only another, what, 6 clicks further up the road, and shot a platypus, but he also began to realise, seeing different things, that this was not working. The great leading facts of paleontology seem simply, as he concluded, quote, to follow the theory of descent with modification through natural selection. For Darwin, killing a platypus in New South Wales had far-reaching outcomes. It was like a pebble cast in a quiet pool, the ripple spread. When amid the outcry, Darwin published The Descent of Man so it's separate things. There was natural selection, the origin of the species, the descent of man. The platypus was to rise again as a clear example of natural selection and a diversified link, what he perceived as an organic change of mammals rising up to man. While the reproductive processes of the platypus and the echidna are still unknown in 1874, Darwin and his monotrema were as eminently interesting as leading in several important points to the structure towards the class of reptiles and structural precursors of marsupials, placentals, and to man. For the world, as the great evolutionist reasoned, appeared as if it had been long preparing for the advent of man. Quote, that's interesting. So it's evolution towards man. He owed his birth, said Darwin, to a long line of progenitors. If a single link in the chain never existed, man would never have been exactly what he is now. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.